I got a letter from a guy who says, Shepherd, what is that strange, almost electric, certainly haunting moan that comes on at the end of your theme song every night when you play your theme song? What is that haunting, strange, terrible moan? Well, I have received at least 5 or 6 letters in the past month or two about that, and I can only tell you this, that there is no strange electric haunting moan that comes on at the end of my theme song. That strange haunting electric moan is the strange haunting electric moan that you yourself are feeling in your own rotten, distorted conscience. That the minute my theme song comes on, you begin to get bugged. And then because you begin to get bugged, and because your buggedness is beginning to bite down there at the bottom of your pancreas, you say, Shepherd is causing it again. That's what's going on with the world today. Everybody's blaming everything on everybody else, you rotten crumb. Stop it. It's no terrible thing there to be bugged. I understand that you're a 20th century man, and we got our problems. And man is not the best possible creature that there is, and I think one of the most delightful myths that we have with us today, Bob, is the myth that has been promulgated and is continuing to be carried forward and mythologically advanced by numerous commentators to the effect that man is basically a beautiful creature and that he's always being led into rotten troubles by the rotten people. That's capitalized, the rotten people. And because the commentator invariably masquerades as one of the beautiful people, he is calling aloud always for all the beautiful people to unite and start feeding all the rotten people into the gas ovens, thereby achieving a purely beautiful world, one based on rationality and beauty. So I don't know, you know, one way or the other. I can't tell whether I'm one of the rotten people or one of the beautiful people. I suppose the world has to be divided into that. It's hard to admit that the beautiful people have a streak of rottenness in them. And just as difficult is it to admit that the rotten people got a streak of beauty in them. That's a terrible problem. You know, it's very, very difficult. And one famous cartoonist recently, while being quoted about democracy, says democracy has failed. The reason it's failed is because a minority has gotten control of the government, and this minority is running it for its own particular aims and purposes and is only releasing the information to the great mass out there that it wants to have released, and thereby it's keeping itself in power. This great political pundit thought. Now the only thing I can say about that is that this is based on the misconception that there is a majority of people. Do you really believe? I wonder if there is a majority anywhere in a big 20th century technologically advanced civilization. Do you really think there is a majority of people? You know, this is a wonderful thing that people are kicking around, what they call the mass of people. Is there a majority of anything? Or does any man who gets in and runs the government automatically, he is a spokesman for a minority? I suspect that our world is composed of 87 million minorities. Really? Now everyone says, oh, come on, now there is a mass of people. Now, wait a minute, what do you mean by a mass? I mean, you got the Presbyterians, you got the Baptists, you got the Catholics, you got the Jews. All these various things are all, you know, they're all operating. And you got them all going. I'm just curious about where the mass begins and where this minority stops, where it begins, you know. You know, speaking of motivations, I suspect that we are all a minority and we are all a majority. At one and the same time, you're a minority on certain subjects, you're a majority on others. And you keep switching back and forth. And it's a matter of motivation. Speaking of motivation, speaking of the fascinating thing that man is, a guy wrote me, a kid who's going to college. He says he is quietly sitting in his classroom, and he's working on Biology 101. He says it's a drag. So he has taken the book out of the library, and the book is a book which I will give to you the title of if you wish to look it up. It's Meinert Sagan's book, published in 1955, entitled The Speed and Attitude of Bird in Flight, with notes on other animals. And guess what other animals are included? Well, he says under the heading he decides to look up what the speed of man is. So he looks up under man, and here is the quote taken directly from this book, which is a recognized work on the subject, Man, Stopwatch Record of a Maasai Warrior Carrying Spear and Shield, Being Chased by a Rhinoceros. Speed clocked 18.4 miles per hour. My God, there he goes. Come on, man, you're doing it for all of us. Up. Too late. Because on the next page it says, speed of rhinoceros, clock chasing man with spear and shield, 30.7 miles per hour. Put that bar, will you, for crying out loud. Lift that bale. Get a little junk, and you become Pfeiffer. Move over. Well, you know, it's wise once in a while to pull things into focus there, to see, you know. And this is a serious work. The book did not go on to say how the warrior did. He did pretty well, obviously, for a short distance. Because it's quite apparent that man's acceleration, I mean, let's say from 0 to 18, is faster than the rhinoceros. However, on the flat, it's obvious that the rhinoceros has the lead. Now, it depends on what chart you look at. Speaking of rhinoceri, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. And we'll be here until, you know. But now you're talking about the condition and the situation of motivation. Now, you can figure at 18.4 miles per hour. That guy's doing a pretty good mile when you think about it. Figure it out. Can anyone figure out how fast he would have covered 100 yards moving at that speed? Or let's say a mile moving at that speed. Has anybody got any mathematics there? This guy obviously was a world record beater. But the thing that was working without any question of a doubt was that he had extreme motivation. Now the motivation is the important part here. Now, that's why they said being chased by a rhinoceros, because you had to know what was under his tail. See, this is not going to go with the AAU. You know, the AAU does not put a rhinoceros behind Jim Elliott. Or I'm sure that there would be a lot of four-minute miles broken, providing you got the right tiger out there on the track. But on the other hand, did you hear, speaking of racing, did you hear the great news today? It's all a part of the way you look at it. There was a little news note that came out today. Since there was a cessation of horse racing in England due to some kind of confusion and strike in the weather and everything else, they've been having rotten weather, no horse racing, there was a big promoter decided what he was going to start was mouse racing. And, yeah, he was going to take odds and everything. and he had his book made up, and there were a whole bunch of guys assembled already. That sounds ridiculous, but they were already ready to cheer. What is more ridiculous? Seriously, why is mouse racing more ridiculous than horse racing? Now, every horse fan is getting bugged the minute you say that, because he can understand horse racing. His frame of reference is based on horses. But there are many of us mouse fans around. Now, I would love to see a mouse race, because I lived in a town where at every fall, all the mouse population out in the fields came into the house automatically. Just like the bums drift into jail, the mice would come into the basement. And every winter at this time, the house was overflowing with little gray ghosts that moved like a bat out of hell. Excuse me, but they did. They'd go in and out and behind the refrigerator like a shadow. So the idea of a mouse race intrigues me, because I literally grew up watching mice run. Now, if you grow up watching horses run, I suppose you're hung on horses. But mice became important to me. And I used to sit in the kitchen eating salami sandwiches, and once in a while I'd go, ah, shoo. He'd go shooting across that linoleum. And in under the refrigerator he'd go. Well, then I would jump up, run behind the kitchen door, and get the broom. And many's the time I would be awakened with muffled curses in the kitchen. My old man is going behind the cupboard after a mouse, banging around, hollering, "Here he goes! Here he goes!" Down under the door he'd go, and into the basement. Well, once they got in the basement, forget it. That was the jungle, and he had made his escape again. But the idea of mouse racing, and now I've raised my hand and tell you, Bob, do you know that they declared mouse racing illegal because they said that it was cruelty to animals? Somehow the idea of a mouse running on a track is cruel, but a horse running on a track is not. Now, what is even more interesting, there's a guy sitting on that poor horse. Now, I don't know of any plans afoot to have people ride the mice. Now, I'm sure you know, it's this weird, crazy logic. I can't figure it out. What is cruel and what isn't cruel? And as was pointed out by Walter Kiernan tonight on an earlier newscast, Kiernan said that they declared racing mice is cruel, but I don't hear anyone saying that trapping mice is cruel. I mean, literally banging them on the head with a thing, you know, busting their neck. So I'm not sure, you know, where does the motivation start? Where does it stop? Where does the peculiar double standard make it? Now, oh yeah, yeah. 1 mile, approximately 3.24 minutes. Holy smokes. Bob just figured it out, and this guy was running a mile in approximately 3.24 minutes. Now, 0.24 minutes would be roughly a third of a minute, wouldn't it? Roughly. Huh? About a quarter. Yeah, about a quarter. He was going about 3.25 miles a minute. In a minute, he would go 3.25. Do you say that he was running a 3-minute mile? 3.24? Holy smokes, 3.25. And he was carrying a shield and a spear. I don't know if Roger Bannister or any of these guys ever carrying a shield and a spear trying to clip that one off. And, by the way, he was not wearing, to my knowledge, track shoes. and another thing that must be pointed out, that his training was highly irregular before that moment. I don't think that he was spending much time out on the track. Motivation again, you see. It's very important. I suspect that almost any one of us could break the 4-minute mile under the proper conditions. I mean, even big fat guys. I'll tell you one time, when you talk about motivation, I saw motivation one time take over. It was an incredible sight. It was really a sight which I will always keep in my mind. A sight which will never be blotted out. I was in basic training in the Army. Now, often in the Army, you run into motivation. Now, you run into motivation in a much rawer form than you run into it in life. Now, danger is often hidden when you're working in the lever house. All the walls are glass and green, and the sun always looks the same from inside the lever house. It looks the same from inside Seagram House. You don't really see it out there. But in the Army, all is stripped down to basics. Well, you've probably heard of the obstacle course in the Army. You've heard of the obstacle course? Well, the obstacle course in the Army works like this. You know, it depends on what kind of training you're involved in. If you're in infantry training, that's one kind of obstacle course. If you're in the Air Force, the obstacle course just consists usually of a few push-ups and thinking's right, you know, little things like that. And that's really the obstacle course. Whereas in the infantry, they don't fool around with thinking right. You just get out there and you move your tail. That's all. And keep low and don't give them a silhouette and dig. Nobody worries about whether you're thinking right or not. You just better move. Well, I happen to be in an outfit that got the nutty idea that what it was going to do was to take infantry basic. Well, the outfit, by the way, that I was in was the Army. Had this nutty idea. So, infantry basic consists of a prolonged, well, it's like if you had, you've all had a wisdom tooth. You ever had an impacted tooth? Well, have you ever had a tooth pulled? Well, now you know that they'll pull a tooth in 4 or 5 milliseconds, actually. Well, now if you could imagine that being prolonged over a period of 9 weeks and done in stages, With no Novocaine. Well, this is really what primary basic means in the infantry. It's a continual harassment. There is a continual fire under your tail. There is continual motivation of the rawest kind. I'm telling you, I was chased for over 4 months by a rhinoceros. He was from Scranton. And this guy was a first sergeant, and I'll tell you, this guy, he made Maasai warriors run up and down that company street. More than one of us broke 4 minute miles mentally every day. We just clip. It was fantastic. Well, I actually saw it happen. Well, I'll describe the scene. They had told us, and it was always traditional, that one day during basic, we would go under actual fire. And they had what they call live ammunition, the basic place. Now, live ammunition, the difference between live ammunition, I cannot tell you the difference. It is literally the difference between watching a movie of, say, The Merchant of Venice, and being the guy that they are about to cut the pound of flesh off of with a paring knife. Right now in your kitchen. There's a very big difference, you know. You can be very theoretical about things until all of a sudden you're shoo, going over your head, you know. And you know this isn't a BB gun. And you also know now when that we, oh, let me tell you, I made a silhouette at one point. I was less than a microfilm thick. I was about a, oh, really, seriously, I was plastered, dug down to the ground there just by sheer willpower. I was hanging onto the core of the earth. Shoo, stuff goes past. Well, here's what happened now on that fateful day. We got over to the live ammunition range, and this comes at the end of basic. By now you're lean and hard, you see, theoretically. All you are is teed off, basically. And you are kind of lean and hard, but it's mostly anger that has made you lean and hard. It's not your muscles that are hard or lean. It is your mind and everything else. You're down to a fine honed thing, you know, with little claws sticking out of you. Well, we arrived on this morning. It was a bright, sunny morning. And we're about six corporals, a couple of lieutenants, and a captain, and maybe a major or something. And there were two platoons of guys out there. Well, the first platoon set out. Now, here's the way it works, really. They have barbed wire. They have holes in the ground, you know, that are like shell holes and mortar holes. They have targets that pop up once in a while, right out of the ground. You know, there's something that pop up like that, and you're supposed to duck down or shoot or fire, and you've got your entrenching tools, and you got to make it from point A to point Z in a certain length of time, or else you just go over it again. That's it. You just keep going over it, over again. Now, if you make a bad mistake, you're liable to get creased. If you make a bad, bad mistake, well, you're liable to get plugged. Well, now there's a mistake that goes beyond that. And that is, they don't even talk about it being plugged. They just talk about it. What they call is a terminal error. It's in the Army, a terminal error. It's a nice way of putting it, you know. So they tell you about this, and the guy's out there, he says, now that's the three kind of things that happen. Now, you can tell the good guys, the guys that have really worked on their training, the men that know what they're here for, men that know there's a war on, they're gonna get there. They're gonna get there in less than 3 minutes. We're going to start out here. When the gun goes off, we want you to go. We want you to dig. We want you to all walk out. And we want you to go in. And we want you to move under fire in platoon formation, skirmish line. I don't want any ad-libbing. I don't want anybody running off. Anybody that starts going off on his own is liable to get into trouble. And is liable to result in what we call here a terminal error. Now, are you all ready, men? Any questions from the men's there? Well, there's no question at all, except, you know, everybody's wondering about the terminal error, and nobody wants to know exactly, because if you know exactly, then you're really in trouble. You know? So everyone just sort of stands there around, you know, with their packs on their back and their things in their mouth, you know, just sort of standing there. Well, all right, so the first platoon gets out there, and we are watching. And it was at this moment that I saw probably the most magnificent single motivated run that I ever saw in my life. They all started out, and you start out sort of half crouching. You see, the idea being you got to get to the next line of trenches before it starts. So everybody starts crawling on their belly, and we're watching. And back of the parapet, they had machine guns like 50 caliber. They had some 30 caliber machine guns. They had little explosions that would go on out in the middle of the field when they pressed buttons. That was a very funny one, too. And they had everything except a couple of 109s flying over you, strafing you, you know. Well, and by the way, they simulated that with loudspeakers. They really did. They had the whole business going. It's real war, you see. So the guys start out, and of course up to this point, everything had been highly theoretical. Everything. We'd been squeezing off dry ammunition, empty rounds, carrying wooden guns, and jumping over wooden parapets. But now there's ground out there. We're all watching. My platoon is standing there. We're just watching. Well, the first thing we heard was, back of us. So Gasser, next to me, turns around, and he looks, and he sees the smoke coming from behind the parapet. He says, yeah, I bet they're putting this on. You know, I bet they're putting this on. And they hear a machine pistol goes like this. Well, so it's good. And then out in front of the platoon, which was advancing now over the field, all of them clinging, making a low silhouette, two mortar shells go boom. These guys dig in. Oh, my. Oh, you can see them disappear. Absolutely disappear. Boom. And then suddenly you hear something bounce. Bounce. Another one goes swishing off into the distance, and you see nothing out there now. And then the lieutenant, the great big stopwatch is going, and the lieutenant gets up. He's, of course, you see the lieutenant is back here where we are. And the lieutenant says, come on, you guys, get moving! You've only got a minute and a half! Get moving! Goes. Well, you see a couple of little heads pop up out there in the distance, and darkness again. Down they go. This is exactly the way the scene went. It was ridiculous. And then, believe me, Errol Flynn wasn't out there with these guys. They were all out there by themselves, you know. That's pretty wild. Well, suddenly one of them got up, and he goes into the next hall. Like that. Dead silence. Another tiny figure leaps up into the hall. Boom! Dead silence. Tiny figure into the hall. You just see him out there. All right, you men, you've just got 45 seconds. Well, these guys are like, looks like a half a mile away from the ending line. And suddenly, without any warning, amid all the gunfire and shooting, Goldberg, who is an old buddy of mine, I see Goldberg jump up out of a hole about two-thirds of the way across the field. Goldberg jumps up, and I have never in my life seen anything like it. You talk about your Maasai warrior. Goldberg shot across that field. He was literally a blur. It was fantastic. Full field pack, carrying an M1, carrying a tin hat, wearing GI shoes. Goldberg was running a 2.7-minute mile. Whoa! And we all stood and watched this. Goldberg shot across that field into the hole at the end. They had a hole, a big shallow trench. He literally beat the mortar shells into that hole Goldberg shot. Well, the lieutenant stood there and he yelled, Goldberg, keep down! Well, Goldberg, you know, you can't run like a Maasai warrior and keep your fanny down. Well, Goldberg, I mean, they are incompatible. Goldberg proved that you could really literally outrun a 30 caliber shot. Into the hole he went. Well, you could see the rest of the platoon was mulling this over. There was silence out there. And the machine guns were going up, and you'd hear pum, pum, pum. Well, way out there the mortars are going pum. Yeah, you know, mortars are terrible. They're pum. And then one after the other. Old Company B's 2nd Platoon proceeds to hurl itself into the maw, and it was then that I formulated my great theory that under motivation, all of us are Olympic champions. It is a matter of motivation. The 2nd Platoon, each one in succession, while the lieutenant was screaming his guts out, proceeded to beat every known law of physics, every known law of the AAU's top running time, and each one, woo! You'd see. Then you see a little head stick up with a tin hat, woo! And then, boom. They'd wait. They were timing it. They'd wait until the burst is over, woo! And then once in a while you'd see a burst of three or four shots going across the field. Three guys or four, you know, at one time. Like that. Well, after it was all over, one guy refused to go. And you could see the whole platoon was over in the other side of the hill now, and there was about 5 seconds left to go. And the lieutenant hollered, "Where's Wilkins? Wilkins! Come on, Wilkins! They're marching! The fire is advancing! Get moving!" Well, see, what they did was advance the fire behind the guys. You know, they didn't just fire in the same place. So the fire is coming up where Wilkins is dug in. And you can say, boom, 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 boom. All of a sudden, Wilkins shot straight out of the ground. Wilkins was actually running in a spiral. I have never seen a man literally run as if he was rifled. Wilkins was taking evasive action and forward action all at the same time and not touching the ground. Wilkins was literally a human ricochet. Into the trench goes Wilkins, beating it by less than a second and a half. We all stood there. But the thing that that caused us all trouble was the thing, of course, when we were going to get under fire. And so it seemed like less than 30 seconds later, I am in a hole. I am in a hole. Gasser is in the next hole. Zinsmeister is in the hole next to Gasser. And we are dug in. And all around us now, it is no longer laughing at Wilkins. It is no longer laughing at Goldberg. I am waiting for my turn. And I could hear this nutty lieutenant now in the distance. Come on, boom, boom, boom. And the dirt comes on my head. They're going over right over my head, like 6 inches above my head. I feel the ground jiggle. I stick my head up just a little bit, you know, trying to keep down this silhouette. I hear him going. And by the way, they said that the guns are trained exactly 6 inches over your prone form. 6 inches. Well, my prone form is real low, you know, especially when I'm prone under these guns. I am very, very low. I am less than 1 micromillimeter thick. I'm hanging down there. So I crawl up on the lip of this thing. Boom. More crud comes down on my hat. Boom! I can see nothing now. My hat is pulled down over my eyes. I got my ears shut. My fingernails are closed. Boom! Oh, I back up. Then I assume that he's hollering at me. I am advancing rapidly backward, back into the hole. I'm hanging down there. And he goes, "Oh, fire is advancing!" What? The fire is advancing. Bloomp! Right behind me. Bloomp! Crud into the hole. I crawl up on the lip, and suddenly I put one foot under the other. I leaped up over the barbed wire. I was moving faster than I had ever moved in my life before. The wind was whistling through my helmet. Moving forward for the first time and the only time in my life, I was not touching the ground. Oh, I was defeating the principle of flight. Boom. Into the hole. At the end of the track. So when I hear about guys like Roger Bannister, when I hear about lesser runners like Jim Behe, when I hear about guys leaping over 7 foot high jumps, I know that deep within inside of me lies a 2.5 minute miler. Deep within me, deep within me. Oh, there goes another one. Speaking of 2.5 minute miles, we have with us Show Magazine. I will not agree with you on feeling sorry for those poor athletes who have to travel. You know, that's always a fascinating thing in sports, as it is in real life, that mostly we like to think that owners are guys who exploit poor, sad, little, hardworking people. You should be so exploited like Louis Aparicio was with the White Sox. But speaking of that's an interesting concept. More and more of the athletes of my acquaintance are feeling sorry just by the mere fact they're athletes. You know, it's a terrible thing. It's like a vaudevillian saying that he doesn't like vaudeville because he's got to travel a lot. You gotta go from town to town. You know, that's a drag. Somehow, if you could bring the customers to the center and the guards, if somehow you could make the customers travel, then it would be the best of all possible worlds. As a matter of fact, I understand that baseball has an idea like that going. It has to do with monorail travel, has to do with bringing people in capsules and all kinds of things. One day, life will be even better for Roger Maris. You know, I believe somewhere, someplace, the pure man exists, standing pristinely, implacably, absolutely incorruptible, with nothing but beautiful thoughts swirling through his superhuman mind.